This is an Enterprise Time Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy, and I'm here in a very sunny San Francisco with RiskIQ.
Hey there, I'm Lou Minousos. I'm the CEO and founder of RiskIQ. We're a cybersecurity company that helps enterprises and organizations move their security program beyond the perimeter.
Getting beyond the perimeter is quite a challenge for organizations. They've started to understand what goes on inside their wall, but actually the perimeter's become very fluid. With mobile workers, there technically is no perimeter. So where do companies begin to start with understanding the perimeter and what goes on?
The first step is to take an inventory of where your business is outside. So what assets are we using? What websites do they have? What mobile applications do they have? Is your customer service on social media? And take that inventory and build a monitoring program to alert the security team, because usually the security guys aren't the first guys to get the phone call from the business when they do something new.
Working out where those assets are, though, has become quite complicated with cloud. Business units go out and somebody goes and buys a cloud service here, a user brings in an app on their laptop and starts using that inside the company. What do companies need to start thinking about in terms of finding those assets? Because the obvious ones, your own website, your own corporate social media, are clearly defined. The rest is, well, like smoke.
The trouble is, last 30-some years of information security have relied on sensors. We deploy them either on an endpoint or on a network, and that's how we get the telemetry to run the program. What RiskIQ provides, and this is what you need to do if you want to start to bring your program out onto the web, is you need to collect internet telemetry, because that will show you where every user on the internet's going, you know, how DNS is resolving, what people are clicking on, and then you analyze all that data to see, are you responsible for that asset? You may not own it, but you may have some responsibility or reliance on it for your own data center or for the operation of some business process. If you don't have that visibility and have a partner that can bring that data to the table, that's really the foundation, is actually collecting what we call internet reconnaissance and building a database that you can build your program on top of.
How do companies begin that without impinging on employee privacy? Because it's one thing to say, yes, we're going to monitor what's going on to find out what cloud services people are using. It's another thing to do that within the rules of personal privacy, what people think they can do on their own devices. And BYOD's blurred that whole area between what's personal and what's business.
So you don't have to solve every layer of the problem. So we guide security teams to focus on domain names, mobile applications, not necessarily the usage, but let's focus on the assets themselves. Where are they located and where are they distributed from in the case of an app store? For a social media profile, just what are the profiles? And I think the next level, and we're not there yet as a community, and yes, we start to look at the behaviors of how people are using these services. And I think the policy's already there. If you go look in your employee handbook, you're going to see there's rules and regulations that have already been written out, just haven't had the technology to monitor. And now that we have the technology, may call into question those policies that were written decades ago, but are still very relevant today. So I think you just start with the easy stuff, which doesn't have the privacy implications. And then as your program matures and you do have the ability to look at those behaviors, you really have to decide if that's something you want to tackle.
How much analysis do you see security teams doing on the edge to find, for example, cloud services? Are they monitoring regularly seen IP addresses? Are they resolving them out and discovering that that's a cloud app that somebody in the company is using and then starting to look to see the type of data that's flowing over that? Or are they still at that point of concentrating on the big stuff without looking for the wider picture?
Well, in terms of cloud usage, I think most people are doing cloud usage monitoring, and you can do that fairly easily by looking at your firewall logs. I think the other thing that people are doing today is they're looking at threats that they're detecting through their firewall, and then they're using internet data to enrich and learn more about those attacks. So those two things, I think, are in most security operations groups are a staple of what they do. Now, there's levels of maturity in terms of how much automation and orchestration they put in place, and I think that's really where we're at right now. I think that's the next phase.
One of the interesting things from that second set of data is if we look at marketing teams, they're already buying in the Twitter hose, they're buying in the Facebook hose and various other places, and they're using that to get reputational information on the company. When's the company name mentioned? Are security teams starting to engage with marketing teams to also get some of that reference data, or is that a gap that needs closing?
It's a great question. Most security teams are behind just in general of the business. We tend to be late, myself included. We're all late to the marketing party. And the marketing teams are always chasing new customers, and so they're going to go to these new platforms first. We do see quite a few companies that leverage the marketing databases that have already been built to communicate with customers on social media. And then we also see security teams either driven usually with executives in mind, like, hey, let's protect a subset of our executives in social media. So that's usually where they'll start. And then depending on the business that they're in, they may have an issue with impersonation of the business entirely, using social media as a phishing vector. So those are the types of things that we see marketing working hand in hand to help the security guys get access to the data. In the case of Twitter, they do provide commercial access to their database, but not all the other social media companies provide that access. So in those areas where you don't have access, you have to figure out how are you going to get the data.
How do we match cultures to solving security? Security teams are very good at putting together programs. This is what you can't do. This is what you can do. Let's give you a lesson on this. What they don't try and do is understand why people are using it, how they're using it, what they're using it for, and then suggest better ways to do it, almost more secure ways to do it. Is there a challenge there on culture that should be driven by security, or should it be driven by other teams like HR? Because it's very much a soft subject.
I think the security professionals that are successful have figured out how to act as a guide. And that's very important, not to just say no, but to say, well, don't do it that way, try this other way. That's what the business is looking for. What we recommend, rather than say, no, don't do this, say, well, when you do this, I will detect it. In which case, then I will have to come back to you and work out a solution. So I think once the business understands this, A, they feel more secure because they know that the security team is out there protecting the business. But B, it also helps set behavior because it's a form of a control to say that you can monitor what's going on. And that puts them in a mode where they're going to look for a more sanctioned way to do things. For example, for cloud services, maybe you want to centralize using a cloud provider just because once it's in that one cloud provider, you can monitor it more easily. So telling the business, this is the cloud provider that we're using, this is how you onboard with that cloud provider, and if you use a different one, we'll find that application and we'll have to start the process of moving it. The security teams that seem to be the most successful have adopted an approach to guide the business in the right direction.
What about establishing a reputation of cloud providers? Because they're out there, they're taking our data, they're looking after it, but there becomes a question as to whether they themselves are enterprise secure. Are you seeing security teams working with end users and saying, hey, we know that a lot of you are using storage provider A because it's cheap, it's free, and you found it on Apple Store. But actually, as a company, we use B. This is why. Let us help you move the data there because we know they'll protect it. Is that a maturity level you're seeing?
The other part of the problem is often people believe that there's more security at these cloud services than there really is. So there's misleading or incomplete information about the true level of security. Has that provider been tested? Who did the audit? Will they give you access to their vulnerability tests? And have they been done at the same level of care that yours was done? The good news is I think the main providers, I won't name them, but the really popular top-level providers have actually done this. And they've been in the market the longest, and they've faced government scrutiny because they've got official programs with various governments. They've worked with large Fortune 500 companies, and they've gone through the ringer. Still, even with that, there are limits to the level of security that they do provide, which then requires you to think about, you know, how you treat data that's stored in those locations. It is a maturity issue, and it's also just an education about the third party. Many of the breaches that have occurred due to a third party. The more you rely on third parties, I think you open yourself up to some level of risk, and it is prudent to at least start with a list of what's out there and what you're using so you can actually measure the risk of that partner.
Opening up to third parties is all part of digital transformation. This whole idea that we go to an API economy, you publish a set of APIs, anybody can come in, write an application, use your data, and your company gains from this. But it has all sorts of associated risks. You don't know how secure their apps are using your APIs. Sometimes you don't know how secure the APIs are you're using from another provider. Where's the level of maturity going to come from in terms of API management?
Not at all, and there's been recent breaches where the APIs of very popular services that haven't been around very long, and these are companies that don't have chief information security officers, they may not even have a security program, get hijacked. So the DNS could be hijacked of that provider, or if that provider has a content delivery network, the JavaScript that they use could be hijacked. It doesn't take much to hijack an entire API service. Now the underpinnings of your application are in control by someone else. That's happened several times in the last 12 months in very high-profile attacks, some of them from nation-states, hacktivists. So I think it's a very valid point. Unfortunately, I don't think you're going to be able to convince your business users to not use these APIs, because that's what consumers expect. They want to see their favorite mapping application. They want to see their favorite reviews application. Those applications are embedded using iframes or other web technology inside your application. So you have very limited choice. Either you say, no, we're not going to do it, or you're allowed to do it. The other one that was recently breached was a very popular chat application for customer support, and that chat application at one time had advertisements that powered the free version of their chat. So that ad server was hacked, and now everywhere that ran that widget, everyone who called that API was injecting malware into their website. Looking at the history of who's been hacked, what the reputation is of the API, I think that's very important, and it allows you to ask the right questions when you're in procurement with that vendor for their API.
One of the challenges for IT is it's always been seen as a blocker to what end users want. And this whole change of APIs, we're seeing end users building applications for themselves and distributing around. In reality, nothing new. We saw that with macros in the late 80s, early 90s when that started to happen. These days, they're not just about internal apps. They're now big external apps. They're pushing data as well as everything else. How does IT change its relationship with the user community? And more importantly, how do IT security teams get themselves into that conversation where they're enabling an assisting rather than being seen as saying no, stop, don't do?
Part of it is that we're all very busy and we have to protect our network. We have to protect the endpoint. And of course, we've got this new problem of all of these services outside of what we traditionally defined as our scope. Who is that person on your team who takes the responsibility for external threats and dealing with third parties and analyzing their code and their processes and their procedures? So the first step there is just structuring the security team properly. So do you have the mandate from the CISO or from the CIO? If you're a CISO, does your boss say, yes, this is something that is in scope? The business, what we found, believes that's what the security team's already doing. And the facts are, we're not always seeing that being the case because the security group is very overworked implementing the technology that just to protect the internal network. So I think it really starts with the mandate, the structure of the team, and if you get the right team in place, then you'll start to solve these problems.
Security teams are drowning under the amount of data internally. Expecting them now to start looking outside is a big ask for many of them. We can't afford the staff. We can't find the staff. We can't train the staff. If we do train the staff, somebody else comes along with a bigger budget and poaches the staff. That's led to an explosion in threat intelligence companies such as yourselves. Where do you now sit in terms of that security relationship? Do you become part of the security team? Do you become a provider of data to the security team? How do you build that relationship?
That problem is related to the way that companies deliver their service. Where we've gone is to become a platform that can be used to solve a particular problem versus just giving someone a feed of data. And I think that is one of the reasons that people are overworked. They're a constant stream of threat intelligence that says, go try to fix this problem, versus a way to automate and close out the problem. And then, of course, the next problem happens. You now have some automated workflow that you can implement again. And that's taking your level one, your entry-level resource, and giving them the tools so they can be effective and do the job of a level three or your most sacred resource that everyone's trying to get to. What we've developed is tools that make it easier to interpret these external threats. So when they do happen, there's maybe 10 things that an analyst has to do to close out that ticket. We want to automate 8 of those 10 steps through our software. So it's not just about the intelligence. I think every security company creates threat intelligence, whether it's an endpoint vendor, network vendor, or an external vendor like RiskIQ. The real key is the workflow and the process that you wrap around that to deliver a true end-to-end solution, and ideally through a platform that solves more than one problem. It's reusable. So that's how we look at it, and I think that's one of the reasons I feel we're successful with our customers, is that's the direction that we push in and how we want to solve the problem generally.
Helping them bring that scope down by giving them a platform is important, because if we look at the amount of threat intelligence out there, I listen to different vendors, I get told that this vendor's getting 15 billion events a day and that's getting 10 billion events a day. And if you're an enterprise sitting in the middle, you look at this and these numbers just become incomprehensible in terms of how do I deal with this. What has been the driver behind the tools, and which tools are you finding companies using the most in terms of automating the ingestion of all this data and just finding out what really applies to them, as opposed to, yes, there's a threat, but it doesn't affect me?
The context is important. What we see most organizations use, there's an IP address, a domain name, a host name, some very basic building blocks of the internet. Almost everyone has a program that can enrich either an attack or a threat intelligence using domain information, DNS information, because that's just how the internet works. So you have to have internet data at your fingertips and through APIs that you can automate those types of attacks. If you skip that step, the problem is you end up with what you just described. You end up with thousands of indicators, but you don't really know contextually how they all relate to one another. So you may have 1,000 tickets in your help desk, which are all related to the same threat actor. And wouldn't it be nice if you could group all of those attacks together and close out that incident with one or two steps instead of having to run every single ticket? And that's probably why a lot of people use these big numbers, is their data has to have the scope required to actually analyze the threat properly.
In terms of those indicators of compromise, typically when we see a piece of malware come along, we get a list of CNC server IP addresses. We get a list of applications or programs that are altered as they install themselves on the machine. But for a lot of organizations, taking that and applying that to their own setup is difficult. How does a platform change that?
I'll give you an example. So one of the things that we have heard recently that's growing and probably never go away till the end of the domain name system is copycat domain names for spear phishing. Company.com, and then they create, you know, company-inc.com. And now that newly registered domain name is used to send a very, very crafty email to an executive or to an important business partner who doesn't notice that that's a different domain name. One thing that we see customers doing is the reaction to that is, well, we need to monitor domain registrations. But you can mix and match. So you can use internal data. What are the newly observed domains and registered domains that have been sent through our email system? And then query back to a system like RiskIQ to filter down that list of email and those list of domain names. So we provide very focused queries so that you can actually query by your brand name. So you're not looking at the 400 plus million domains that have been registered on the internet. You only need to look at the newly registered domains that contain variations of your brand. And now that would apply to, for this use case, for spear phishing, you know, help you really understand if any targeted attacks are coming inbound through your email gateway. So that's just one example of how you have to not only have all the data, but you have to have a way to really analyze it quickly and make it actionable for that company. Otherwise, you're going to have to look at every single registered domain name. There's hundreds of thousands of new domains a day. That becomes a really big job and result in you, unfortunately, doing nothing if you had to look at that many indicators.
You talked about automation earlier. One of the keys of automation is it shows how mature an organization is, because it's gone through a set of processes, it's looked at them, it's refined them down to being very simple processes. And perhaps that's a challenge for organizations. They try and automate a very complicated thing instead of breaking it into smaller steps. As companies move towards greater automation, is that going to substantially improve their security, or will it enable them to refocus what they're looking for?
The first thing that automation does is, if you've seen the movie before, you don't have to see it again. It eliminates repetition. You know, good programmers, they don't do things again and again and again. They, you know, out of laziness, they really program it out of their life. And I think that's what the playbooks that people develop now, you should focus on the incidents that you see the most of. So that frees up time for your level 2 and level 3 analysts. They don't have to be troubled with these escalations. Through enrichment and using internet data, you also can find, well, maybe this isn't a level 1 incident. Maybe this is something that we need to treat more seriously. So it also helps you escalate things so that now your more senior staff is triaging the incidents that have the most potential to do some damage. That's really where I see people focusing, is let's take the repetitive tasks that happen often, let's automate those, and then use automation to then enrich data so we aren't missing these needles in the haystack. We can make those signals stronger and get them to the right people.
How many customers have gone as far as taking their automation and feeding that into their incident response? And by that I don't just mean the how do we escalate internally, but who needs to know, what do they need to know, what outside agencies do we need to inform, how do we need to inform them, what should we be doing in terms of customer data, PR management, things like that. Is that on the table for a lot of customers at the moment, or is again that a level of maturity that some are at and others are still progressing towards?
I think it's a journey, that's for sure. I think everybody's in this journey. Some are further along. I had to pick a number of how many, it's in the hundreds that have probably implemented in a way that you described at a mature level. There's tens of thousands of companies that are thinking about it. And my view is the most important is that you've started down that journey. I mean, you look at other mature security programs like identity management. We've been on that journey for a decade plus. This is not going to go away. It's not a fad. I think this journey will continue, and it'll be 4 or 5 more years before we see it get to the second level of maturity where everything is completely automated and orchestrated. And part of the challenge there is the partners that you're talking to, can they actually take things in an automated way? And those standards are either being disputed as not being the standard that everyone likes, or they're just not being used yet. So it's going to take some time.
Looking at a month is tough in security. Asking you to look at a year is probably even tougher, but I'm going to do that. If I say to you, looking at over the next year, what do you see as being the challenges for security teams and the things that people need to start putting in place now?
The big challenge is still around structuring the team. I see that problem not going away. We talked about it earlier. We don't have enough staff. There's training gaps. So building your program and architecting it properly so that you can make use of the resources you have. Just general advice that people need to spend more time on that. There's never going to be a day when you wake up and there's not a big pile of incidents or tickets or however you're managing your latest emergency. Like the last thing we heard about was the Struts issues that had many Fortune 500, really every company, seriously looking through their infrastructure to see if they've patched those. And there's always a heartbeat of the week. So Struts was the latest one. There's SSL certs being deprecated and CAs getting pulled out of major browsers. So that every week there's going to be some incident like that. So building your program so that you can handle those issues, we focus on the external threat side of it. Why is this relevant? Well, if there's an attacker out on the web that's using that vulnerability to their advantage, then that's something you want to prioritize. So better ways to prioritize the actions you take based on real-world use cases is another thing that I recommend. So you may not get to automating everything, but just simply knowing that this attack is underway now, that there's a proof of concept that is in the wild, well, you might want to prioritize that, which allows you to just make use of the limited resources that you have.
Thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thanks.